Throughout history, people have tried to find the secrets of longevity. Turning back the clock, avoiding aging. This has been a desire that most cultures have possessed. You may have heard of the story of Ponce de Leon. You remember that? How he went searching for what? The fountain of youth. How many of you have heard of the Holy Grail? Have you heard of that? Wasn't that also about longevity, never aging? But I'd like to suggest to you that past pursuits of these mythic solutions are actually giving way to science that is suggesting we actually have the potential to slow the aging process. I want to look at a very important subject with you tonight, but before we do, I've got a question. Wouldn't it be nice if there was some way, to actually tell or determine how we're doing when it comes to turning back the clock? Wouldn't that be wonderful? There was something we could measure. Now you say, that might sound kind of far-fetched, but let's just take an example, heart disease. Are you aware that heart disease is still the leading killer in America? Both men and women, leading cause of death is heart disease. Are there any tests that we can do that can predict the likelihood of someone dying of a heart attack? Any tests that can give us some idea, some prediction? Okay, a stress test. If we put someone on a stress test, we do that at Weimar. It's one of the things we do. We evaluate people's hearts before we put them on an exercise program. We get them walking on the treadmill. And if they're very fit, before it's all finished, they may end up running on the treadmill. If they're very unfit, they may just walk for a minute or two, and it's all done. But the idea is to stress the heart so that we can see if there's any blockage in the heart blood vessels. And we can predict, based on that test, whether someone's likely to have a heart attack or not. Are there other tests that can give us some insight or some prediction as to whether someone is likely to have a heart attack in the near future? Okay, lipoprotein A, that's one. What else? CRP, C-reactive protein, a marker of inflammation. That's true. Okay, yeah, a CT scan, a special CT scan that looks at the coronary arteries. We can do that. There's a lot of them, aren't there? But what about a test that looks at longevity across the board? I would like to suggest to you that such a test may exist, and it has to do with hemorheology. If we could assess your hemorheology, we could assess how you're doing in your quest to live a long time. In harmony with the title of today's presentation this evening, we are talking about what? The Methuselah factor. I'd like to suggest to you that Methuselah had very good hemorheology. You say, well, what is hemorheology? Hemo actually refers to blood. And rheology refers to the science of the flow properties of complex fluids. Do we have any people who have engineering training in our midst here? Okay. Some of you study rheology? Is this a familiar concept in the physics of fluids? That may be something that some of you studied, but rheology is talking about complex fluids. Blood is a complex fluid. It's not just water. It's not just oil. You know, the most fluids we think of are fairly simple, at least in our everyday experience. But blood is actually a mixture, not only of water, but of cells and of proteins. So it's a very complex fluid. And the science that studies how well your blood flows is called hemorheology. Here's some definitions. If you like some textbook definitions of hemorheology, One is the science of the physical properties of blood flow in the circulatory system. Here's another one. The science of the relation of pressures, flow, volumes, and resistances in blood vessels. You say, well, you know, those are all good medical dictionary definitions, but if you just catch the essence of what I'm trying to communicate to you, you understand what hemorheology basically is. It's simply the science that describes how effectively your blood is flowing. And if the blood is flowing effectively, you can get nourishment to your cells effectively, and you can remove wastes effectively. So the question is, why is hemorheology important? You heard Dr. Guthrie introduce me. And you say, well, here's this doctor. He goes around giving lectures. He does radio shows. Well, you know, a guy like that, he's probably got to come up with new ideas every now and then. So one day he probably was laying in bed, and he thought up this word hemorheology. He made it up and decided he would tell people that in his talk. So it'd, you know, act like he was telling them something interesting and new that they hadn't heard about before. Well, did I just make this up? No. This is a very well-established area in science. It's really a cutting-edge area in science. And yet it really also reflects some age-old wisdom. One writer put it this way, decades ago, perfect health depends on perfect circulation. You think there's wisdom in that? Yeah. Actually, by the way, the author of this statement, I'm not saying it was original with her, it was actually a woman who wrote back over 100 years ago. One of the books she wrote was called Ministry of Healing. Any of you heard of that book? Written in 1905. Amazingly, that book is still in print today. And for example, in that book, just to give you an idea of how cutting edge it is, it talked about tobacco being a slow, insidious, and most malignant poison. Those are the exact words. What does malignant refer to today? Cancer. Do you know when scientists conclusively linked tobacco smoking with cancer? Yeah, late 50s, early 60s. This was 1905. One of my favorite pictures that I have in my collection is a picture of some athletes blood doping. You know what blood doping is? Where they try to take substances to improve their performance. This is Tour de France, cyclists. And guess how they were blood doping? In the 20s and 30s, I think, is where this picture was taken from. They were smoking during the tour to try to improve their athletic performance. Really? Obviously, they had not read Ministry of Healing. By the way, if you don't have a copy of that book, I think there are people here that could help you get your hands on that book. Classic health book. Perfect health depends on perfect circulation. Tonight, I'm going to just let you know where we're going. First of all, I'm going to help you see that hemorheology is really important. We're going to look at some fascinating scientific data that shows you if you can really improve your blood fluidity, you can accomplish all kinds of wonderful things as far as your health. But I'm going to let you know where we're ultimately going. This is a very practical lecture. We're not just going to talk about scientific journals and medical research, but we're going to go through 8 essential elements that can improve your blood fluidity. And it just happens to be easy to remember if you just remember the phrase new start. Can all of you remember a new start? I actually work at the New Start Clinic at Weimar Institute in Weimar, California, just off of I-80 outside of Sacramento, about 45 minutes. And New Start stands for 8 essential elements for health. Here they are. Some of you have probably heard this before. N stands for what? Do you see it up there? Nutrition. We're going to talk about what kind of nutrition is best for hemorheology or blood fluidity. E stands for exercise. W for water. S for sunshine. T for temperance. We'll talk about just what that means. A is for air. R for rest. And then T for trust in divine power. Don't worry if you haven't gotten that all down just yet, because we're going to go over each one of these in detail before we finish tonight. So we're talking about this Methuselah factor. That's the way I often refer to optimal hemorheology. And you know, a lot of people have trouble remembering hemorheology. Some of you may actually leave the lecture tonight and you're going to say, what was that word he was talking about? Do you think that's possible? I know some of you are writing it down, but it's possible. Some of you might leave and you say, what was that? We'll just call it the Methuselah factor. Okay? And that's perfectly acceptable. But hemorheology is the scientific term. And just in case you thought I dreamed it up or making something big out of this when it's really not, I'm just going to tell you in short that all of these things on this list and more in the medical research literature have been connected with hemorheology. Stroke, coronary artery disease. By the way, do people die of stroke in our country? Yes. By most measures, it's the third leading cause of death in America. Next on the list, you see coronary artery disease, heart attacks. That's number one, I told you. What about this one, blindness? Do a lot of people die in our country from blindness? No. So it really doesn't matter whether you lose your vision or not, does it? No, it matters a lot, because we're talking about what? Quality of life. Remember, we mentioned that last evening, that quality of life and longevity, the same factors enhance both. And we're going to look at this in this New START mnemonic, this memory device that helps you remember these eight elements. So blindness, glaucoma, and macular degeneration. If you have diabetes, your greatest likelihood of going blind is from diabetes. But if you don't have diabetes, these are the two leading causes of blindness in adults. Glaucoma, which is increased eye pressure, and macular degeneration, which is a loss of the sensitive visual portion of the eye. Both of them preventable, at least in part, if you can improve your circulatory system. Cancer, the number two killer, it's on the list. Hemorheology has been linked with it. Cognitive decline. How many of you would like to live to be 100, be perfectly physically fit? You could run a marathon at 100. How does that sound to you? I mean, a lot of you are nodding your head. You say, that sounds great. But what if I told you that even though you could run a marathon, you were totally out of touch with reality? You had severe dementia. Would that be a great quality of life? No. So our mental health is important, isn't it? And so when we think about successful aging and turning back the clock, it's not just living longer. It's maintaining quality of life. It's maintaining our senses. It's maintaining our mental acuity. What else can you prevent or decrease your risk of by having optimal blood fluidity? High blood pressure, also known as hypertension, diabetes, and high cholesterol. Obesity is actually also on the list. You see it's on this one right here, weight gain at the bottom. Let's look at a few of these things together. And I'll just show you a few things from the medical research literature on this. I could go through example after example. By the way, this medical research study was published in a journal called Clinical Hemorheology and Microcirculation. So there's whole journals that are written about hemorheology. It's so important. In this 2004 study, they took some 300 individuals who had had either a stroke or a TIA. How many of you have heard of a TIA? Okay, I see a number of you have your hands up. Others of you are wondering what we're talking about. TIA stands for transient ischemic attack. Often in lay circles, it's called a mini stroke. What's unique about the TIA, it looks just like a stroke, but it resolves completely, usually in a matter of minutes, but by definition, it has to resolve completely within 24 hours. So that's a TIA. So it's an indication of blockage or poor flow to the brain. Stroke is a full-blown event where you have actually loss of brain function, loss of brain tissue. So in this study, they took 300 people with evidence of what we would call cerebrovascular disease, disease in the blood vessels going to the brain, and they compared them with 73 healthy people. And when they compared the two groups, they found that there were a number of factors that increased the likelihood of having a stroke or a TIA. Now, if you look at these factors, they may not seem significant to you, but every single one of these factors is a determinant of hemorheology. Hematocrit, for example, that's the percentage of your blood that is made up by red blood cells. The higher that is, the higher your risk of stroke. Plasma viscosity and whole blood viscosity, measures of how viscous or how thick your blood is, making it very simple. Fibrinogen, a clotting protein, and red blood cell aggregation. That's the tendency of red blood cells to stick together. What I'm trying to help you see is that when the researchers look at hemorheology, you can't just go into Google and type hemorheology. A lot of the studies that look at blood fluidity never even mention the term. They just talk about other things that affect your blood health, like these factors here. But the point is, however you measure it, anything that makes your blood less likely to flow smoothly increases your risk of stroke and TIA. Let's talk about coronary artery disease. Some of you like pictures better than what I just showed you, which was not a picture, but what? It was just words. So some of you are visual people. And if you look here, this is the age-adjusted odds of an ischemic heart event. What that means is your risk based on your age, so comparing age, you know, people 50 years of old age with other people 50, for example, it's looking at their risk of having a heart attack. That's what an ischemic heart event is. It's the main type of ischemic heart event. And what we're looking at here is one measure of hemorheology, plasma viscosity. Okay, the higher the viscosity, what do you think? Your blood flow better or worse? It flows worse. What's a very viscous fluid? Can you give me an example in everyday life? What would be a very viscous fluid? What? Honey, okay, or molasses. Yeah, they're viscous. What's a fluid that's not, that has little viscosity or low viscosity? Water, okay, there you go. So, the more viscous, look at this difference. They compared this population and they found those with the lowest quarter of viscosity had about one-third the risk of a heart event as those with the highest viscosity. What I'm trying to show you is how important this is, and what we're learning is that this New START approach lowers plasma viscosity. The New START approach makes the blood cells less sticky. The New START program helps your blood flow more freely. Are you with me here? It's starting to look like it's really important. Let me show you something else here. Blindness, glaucoma, and macular degeneration, this Methuselah factor, optimal hemorheology, how does it relate? Here's a study looking at glaucoma, a leading cause of blindness, as I mentioned earlier. They found higher blood viscosity. What does it do? Higher risk of glaucoma. Another study, they looked at those with glaucoma and those without glaucoma, and look what they found. The same kind of factors that make your blood fluidity bad, they increase your risk of problems with losing your vision because of high pressure. Whether it's stickiness of the blood cells, erythrocytes, another name for red blood cells, fibrinogen, same kind of list. Different studies looking at different things. Do you see this common theme occurring? Let's look at cancer. This is a fascinating one. This was a study that looks at this age factor, hemorheology, the Methuselah factor, call it whatever you'd like. Just remember the point here. And they actually measured plasma viscosity in women who had been diagnosed with female cancers. These women were getting ready for surgery, and they measured blood viscosity. What was so interesting about this is they found that the women with high blood viscosity had a higher risk of having a blood clot after the surgery. You say, well, that's what's so interesting about that. If your blood is thicker, more likely, well, of course you're going to have more clots. But this is where it gets really interesting. because they found that viscosity was not only a predictor of thrombosis, blood clots, they also found it was a significant risk factor for overall survival. In other words, the ladies with ovarian cancer, if they also had thick blood, if you will, and I hate the term thick blood, we use it in lay talks, but it's viscous blood. It's very specific. But anyway, if their viscosity was higher, they were more likely to die. And you say, well, you know, why would this be connected? Were they dying of strokes and heart attacks? No, look what the authors concluded. And I'll just read what they wrote in medical language in the journal. There was actually also in this journal, Clinical Hemorheology and Microcirculation. But then I'll explain it to you. They said in gynecologic cancer patients, that's female cancers, the combination of an increase in RBC aggregation, that's the tendency of red blood cells to stick together, and plasma viscosity impairs blood flow properties. What are they talking about? Hemorheology. Do you see that? They're saying these things worsen hemorheology, and look what they're theorizing. It may induce hypoxia, that's lack of oxygen in the microcirculation, that favors thrombosis. They're speaking here of microthrombosis, really, tiny little clots that then allow settlement of tumor cells and thus metastasis. What they're saying is why survival was connected, why recurrence of cancer, why death from cancer was related, they believe, was if your blood is not healthy, if you don't have good circulation, you get these miniature blood clots in the tiny blood vessels, and then cancer can lodge there and set up shop, and you can have metastasis. Do you see how that works? So very interesting, a connection with cancer in hemorheology. Let's talk about mental functioning, and some recent conclusions have been drawn. The first one is that hematocrit, that's the thickness of your blood as expressed in the percentage of blood made up by red blood cells. It shows a U-shaped relationship. Let me show you what this looks like. This is hematocrit, and this is choice reaction time. This is a measure of how well your brain is working. Now, if your brain is working fast and I ask you a question, will you answer it quickly or slowly? Yes, this person said quickly, her brain is functioning well. She must have drank plenty of water before she came to the meeting. So look here, though. The higher the number, the slower the reaction. So higher numbers are bad on this scale. Now look at hematocrit. The higher the hematocrit after a certain point, the worse the mental functioning. You see, the times are getting worse. They're getting longer. But if your hematocrit is too low, this is anemia down in here, then your reaction time is also impaired because you're not getting enough oxygen to your brain. You see how that works? So the optimal hematocrit is a lower normal hematocrit. Are you aware that there is a gender that tends to have a lower hematocrit? Do you know that? Is it the male gender or the female that tends to have a lower hematocrit? Yes, it's the female gender. They tend to have a lower hematocrit. And this actually, as far as mental functioning, is actually desirable. So men may have to work a little harder to keep up with the ladies around them. And they may have to be careful not to eat too many things that will make their hematocrit too high. Or they need to donate more blood. Actually, this is very interesting. Because plasma viscosity, hematocrit, you see, there's a U-shaped curve. Plasma viscosity, the higher it is, the worse the mental functioning. Higher hematocrit, worse mental functioning. So do you want good blood fluidity for optimal mental functioning? Yes. Enough technical stuff for you tonight? You get the point? I didn't just make this up. And so I'm not going to talk with you about all these other things. I just wanted to lay the groundwork. We could spend all night talking about these, but I will make a few points about weight gain. Because researchers are also finding that if you measure certain indicators of blood fluidity, it actually is a predictor of weight gain. So if your blood is not flowing smoothly, you're more likely to gain weight. Why would that be? Well, it may have to do with your metabolism not being as efficient. There's a number of possible reasons for it, but the point is you're more likely to have weight problems if your blood is not very fluid. So, main conclusion thus far, hopefully, have you caught this already? The Methuselah factor, hemorheology, optimal hemorheology is important. Are we all there together? I didn't just make it up. It's really important stuff. So now this begs at least two other questions, doesn't it? The first question most people have is, where do I stand? What is my Methuselah factor? What is my H factor score? Wouldn't you like to know that? Well, I'd like to tell you, you know, that after the meeting we have, you know, a $100 test that's going to do that for you, but we don't. I have nothing to sell you as far as testing. In fact, mostly these tests are done in research circles. But the interesting thing is, no matter where you stand, I think you should ask this question, what can we do about it? Think about it. Let's say we could measure it, and you had the best score in the room. Does that mean you shouldn't care about it? You shouldn't try to be better? No. You should try to have the best hemorheology possible. Isn't that clear? So when we go over these things, you might think you're doing pretty well, and if you are, that's great, but try to look for areas where you could improve, because it's going to increase your likelihood of longevity and optimal quality of life. So no matter where you stand, let's try to give you some strategies that will help your blood be as fluid as possible, to have as much benefit from optimal hemorheology as you can possibly get. So we're going to look at these eight strategies in some detail. We're going to go through this New START acronym and show you why each one of these is important. So there's the list again: nutrition, exercise. Why don't you read them out loud so you can help retain it better? Go ahead and read that list as a group. Okay, very good. So look around you, and you can see people who, if you forget the New START acronym, you just ask one of these people here. Make sure you've got a friend here in the audience, someone you can call, because you might go home tonight, and you might be just, you know, left with New TART, you see, because you can't remember what the S stands for. And a New TART is not as good as a New START, is it? Okay, so where does New START come from? Any of you wondering, where did this come from? How did Wiemar come up with this acronym, New START? Any of you wonder where it's from? Actually, New START comes from the book of Genesis. Genesis chapters 1 and 2. I mentioned it in the meeting this morning. If you weren't here, they have that on tape or on CD. You know, we don't tape things anymore. CD, I don't know how they distribute those. Is that what you do? You give out CDs? You sell them? What do? Oh, if it's your friend? Oh, okay. Okay, they give them on a donation basis. Isn't that a deal? So be friendly there with Benjamin, and he can give you a CD of this morning's presentation. Genesis chapters 1 and 2 have all of these eight elements. You can study it. And what's fascinating, I heard that this Bible study group that's meeting at Dunsmuir, have I got it? Okay. That I mentioned, they've actually looked at how those very same elements that were in the beginning are again reinstituted at the conclusion of time in Revelation 21 and 22. So a very fascinating study. If you want to study more about this, is it true, Randy, that you're leading out in this study? Well, there's Randy Hess, and he can walk you through this. There's a nice group that's meeting. If I lived closer, I would make a point to try to be there. But it's a long trip from where I live, 5 or 6 hour commute. So I'm glad I could be here this weekend, but I'll probably miss Tuesday night study. It sounds great. So that's where New START comes from. You can find all those eight elements in the beginning and in the recreated earth that's described in the Bible. Let's look at them. Nutrition. It's not just any diet. How many of you remember I pointed out to you that in the Hebrew scriptures, in Genesis 1, a diet was described as being optimal. Do you remember what it was? That's right. It was a total vegetarian diet. Now, I've been a vegetarian for many years. I was not raised a vegetarian, I told you last night. Frequented those fast food restaurants and can't say I'm proud of my dietary history. But some years ago, I was running a consulting company, and a small medical publisher asked me to do some research on phytochemicals. How many of you have heard of phytochemicals? Okay. Phytochemicals literally mean plant chemicals. Phytochemicals are only found in plants. And so this publisher wanted me to look through the medical research literature, and he was making a table up for lay people that went through these phytochemicals and their benefits. And so I'm doing this project, going through all these medical research studies, and I'm reading about allylic compounds and ellagic acid and hesperidin and resveratrol and lycopene and lutein and zeaxanthin and all these phytochemicals. And it's just amazing. There are hundreds of these phytochemicals. And where are they found? They're found in plants. Are they found in animal products? No, they're found only in plants. And it's like the plants are just loaded with these things. And so as I'm reading through this, I'm thinking about my own lifestyle. Now, I didn't tell you this, but although I may not look like I'm of this heritage, three of my grandparents were born in Italy. I actually look more like the Irish and English grandparent. But so I come from Italian stock. So when I was growing up, what kind of foods do you think were commonly on the De Rose table? The family name was originally De Rosa. Okay, what do you think? Yeah, there was cheese and pasta. It was white pasta. So even after I became a vegetarian, for many years I was eating that white pasta. And after I did this research, I was eating a lot of whole grain pasta by that time, but I'll tell you, I said, look it, I only have so much room in my stomach. Why don't I eat with the highest quality nutrition? You see? Why would I want to eat the white pasta when I can eat the whole wheat pasta and get more phytochemicals and nutrients? You might be asking the same question. Why would I want to eat cheese or meat or eggs that have how many phytochemicals? None. When if I want to get the most nutrient-dense foods, I'm not saying you all have to be total vegetarians. I'm just saying this changed my whole perspective. And I already was conscientious about what I was eating. It said it's not about what I'm restricting. It's not about, but I just want to eat the best stuff. It's like if someone came here, or if I said, look it, my grandfather, wealthy grandfather, just died. And he was a metal collector. And he gave me so much copper, I don't know what to do with it. You know, copper is quite valuable today. And so when I came over here from Weimar, I brought a truck. And I've got three compartments in it. One compartment is just full of these copper ingots. I'm willing to give them out. Anyone want copper ingots after the program? Just come and ask me for them. Okay, I see some hands raising. So, but, you know, I'll tell you what. In one of the other compartments, he's a metal collector. And he had all this silver. I don't know what to do with all this silver. So I've got another compartment. It's all filled with silver. And I don't know what to do with it. I brought so much of it. And then the worst problem I've got is the third compartment's all filled with gold. Okay. Now, let's say, okay, I see hands raising. Let's say that you've just got a finite amount of space, or your car can only pull so much, carry so much weight. What do you want me to load your car with? You want me to go with the bronze, the silver, or the gold? Which one? Is it a difficult decision? Well, then why is it so hard with us when it comes to nutrition? Why are we always choosing the bronze stuff? You say, well, this isn't really that bad. You know, I'm really pretty healthy. I'm doing better than my next door neighbor. Do you see what they eat? You know, I was just at the restaurant. Did you see what those people across there? They had 3 servings of dessert. I only had 2. Okay? You know, I'm being quite health conscious. Do you want to be on the bronze program? Hey, now we're starting to think Olympic terms, right? Copper, bronze, whatever it is. Silver or gold? What I'm just trying to help you see, this finally settled in on my mind. After many years of thinking I was health conscious, I said, look it, I want to just eat the very best stuff. And, you know, we could do a whole seminar, and maybe it's going to happen, or maybe you've already been having. I mean, you've got a new registered dietitian here. I've heard there's all kinds of stuff happening here about nutrition. Is that right? Am I telling the truth? What have you got going on here between the two of you? You got a cooking class coming up or something? Do you really? When is that coming up? April 25. What day of the week is that? Sunday afternoon. Do you know what time it's going to be at? To be announced. April 25th. Do you ever talk about phytochemicals?
Yes.
Oh, they do? Okay. You know what I like? I like when people just don't talk about nutrition. They actually feed me. You see? So I got to apologize. Often I make it a condition that I won't give a talk on nutrition unless people prepare food for everyone that comes, and I forgot to make that request here. So you're just going to have to come to the cooking class on April 25th. And then there's something else that you're pairing with it, right? Gardening. So not only are you going to eat this good, healthy plant food, well, what are you growing in the garden? Is it animal products? And yeah, what are you growing in the garden? Is it meat and... You grow fruits and vegetables. Do you want to know something amazing? There's some people that have never seen fruit growing on trees and vegetables growing on plants. I mean, you think that's strange. True story, there once were some screams coming out from behind our facility that we ran outside of New York City. Someone ran out to see what was the matter. There was a little girl out there. She was in the garden. Mommy, look, there's tomatoes and they're on a plant. Really? New York City, you don't see too many gardens. At least back then you didn't. Maybe people are growing more roof gardens and balcony gardens today. But these foods, these plant foods, are the leaders. How many of you have heard about anthocyanins? You heard about these? Powerful health-giving properties. You don't even have to ever have heard of anthocyanins if you've been eating things like red apples and grapes and berries, cherries, tomatoes, onion, garlic. You've been getting anthocyanins. You know what you've been doing for yourself as you've been eating those things? Look, these are just some of the benefits of anthocyanins. They have antioxidant properties. Look at this. You've all heard of vitamin E and C, haven't you? These anthocyanins are more potent than vitamin E, vitamin C, and beta-carotene in laboratory tests as it relates to oxidizing the bad cholesterol, which is related to damaging your heart arteries. They help relax your blood vessels. What do you think that does to your blood fluidity? It helps the blood flow better. It lowers blood pressure. They're anti-inflammatory. They activate cartilage repair. Any of you have joint problems? You would want to get more anthocyanins. It's cancer preventive. By the way, things that are anti-inflammatory lower this C-reactive protein that someone mentioned, and it helps the blood flow more smoothly. So, what can you do to improve your blood fluidity? Eat more apples. That's right. We talked about curcumin, actually turmeric, earlier today. And turmeric, in addition to being anti-inflammatory, helps prevent cataracts. It's cancer preventive. It decreases platelet stickiness. What are platelets? Do you know? Yes, these are cells. They're actually cell fragments that are involved in clotting. If you make the platelets less sticky, what do you think happens to your hemorheology? It improves. So do you know what? The people that were our gracious hosts here in Mount Shasta, you know what they served us at lunch? They allowed us to sprinkle on our vegetables turmeric. You see? It has a very nice taste. If you don't put too much of it on there, maybe some of you like a lot. But look at this. It also is possible protection for neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's. So don't, this simple herb. So what kind of things do we want to be eating more of? We want to be eating more of these plant products, more of these herbs, more of these vegetables. Here's another one, ferulic acid. Ferulic acid, even if you didn't know about it, you were getting ferulic acid when you were eating the citrus fruits and oats and whole wheat. Now, did you catch that? Whole wheat. Look, antioxidant can improve blood sugar control if you've got diabetes. Eating more of these whole grains, it's cancer preventive. It's anti-cancer. It's a lung cancer preventive compound, ferulic acid. We could just go through, we could spend a whole night and weeks going through these, but we don't have to do it. And I don't have to feel guilty that I didn't, because you've got some of these wonderful teachers right here in Mount Shasta that on April 25th, and I'm sure subsequently, we'll be doing cooking classes, giving you more education, and not just talking to you like this doctor, but they're going to actually feed you. Is that true? Whoa. I mean, I can't compete. Glad we're not taking a vote. I'm not going to tell you about all the good things in isoflavones and lycopene. You may have heard of that. That's getting a lot of attention because of its cancer preventive properties. It also lowers LDL cholesterol. But let me just show you something very interesting. As we put all these things together and we start eating more of these phytochemical-rich foods, this is a very famous study that was conducted here in California looking at Seventh-day Adventists. Many of you may realize that Seventh-day Adventists have come into the spotlight in medical research circles and in lay circles in recent years. They've been featured on the cover of National Geographic. USA Today recently ran an article talking about how to live to be 100. And one of the top 10 things they said to do was what? Did any of you see that article? They said, live like a Seventh-day Adventist. Why are people saying this? They're not Seventh-day Adventists. It's because of research like this. This looks at the average non-Seventh-day Adventist male. This was a study of men done some years ago. Just the interesting aside, women were included in the study, but they had too few heart attack deaths in this study for them actually to draw any conclusions, so they could just look at the men. The non-Adventist men living in California, this was their rate of death, 100% of predicted. That's how they compare things in population studies. Then they looked at the Seventh-day Adventists who were not vegetarians. They had only half the risk of dying of a heart attack at any given age. But then when they looked at the vegetarian Adventists, only about one-third the risk of their non-Adventist neighbors. But the lowest, very lowest risk of heart attack death was in those who were eating exclusively fruits and grains and vegetables, nuts and seeds and beans. And by the way, if a vegetarian diet doesn't sound too interesting to you, are you aware that if you look at people on a vegetarian diet, their diet is often more varied than those who are eating animal products? It may sound like you're restricting yourself, but when you open up the door to all this variety of plant foods that are loaded with what? Phytochemicals, you also get more variety. And it's a wonderful thing, especially when you learn how to cook it. And you'll get that when? April 25, that's right. You're a good group. You're alert. Here's an example from the cancer area. I showed you how eating more fruits and vegetables can decrease your risk of heart disease. Here's an example from that same Seventh-day Adventist health study on how decreasing your consumption of red meat can dramatically decrease your risk of one of the leading cancer killers in our country. By the way, if you don't smoke, the most likely cancer to kill you is colon cancer. Across the board, if you take in both men and women, colon cancer, number one cancer killer of non-smokers. The reason for that, although more women die of breast cancer, not many men do. So when you combine the two, and many men die of prostate cancer, but of course no women do. So colon cancer, if you look across the board, both sexes, non-smokers, leading killer, you can dramatically decrease your risk of cancer. Look at, decrease it like 2 to 3 times by decreasing your red meat consumption. You know, many times what happens, what I've noticed, is ladies often get more interested in nutrition before their husbands do. It's not always that way. Sometimes it's the man that gets more interested. But in our culture, often women get more interested in being health conscious. And what happens is when they start getting more health conscious, the men in their lives often get upset. They think, well, why are you taking away my favorite foods? But really, you should look at this as a sign that the woman in your life love you. You see, if they're giving you more meat, what should that be an indication of? Be careful here. I don't want anyone elbowing anyone else here. This would be inappropriate in this context, okay? Here's the point. If your wife or your significant other does not love you, then they will be giving you those rich steaks and milkshakes and ice cream sundaes. Are you with me? That's if they're educated, at least. Okay? So look at this as a sign of love. So for Valentine's Day, you know what to give the special loved one in your heart. I'm not going to even tell you. I think you can connect the dots. Pancreas cancer, very serious cancer. You can see here, if you eat lots of meat, poultry and fish, over double the risk as opposed to those who are eating those things seldom. Eggs, look at this. High egg consumption, dramatically increased risk of pancreatic cancer. But look at, the opposite is true with beans, lentils, and peas. You see, those who eat these things less have high risk of pancreas cancer. Those who eat them a lot have very, very low risk. Interesting, isn't it?
Why eggs so high?
Why eggs so high? Eggs actually, in many studies of cancer, have high relationship with cancer. And many people think it actually has something to do with the similarity of the egg protein to human proteins. We used to think that was something good, but now we realize that this may be feeding some of the metabolic machinery and some of the growth factors that may be involved in cancer. So it's not something that's desirable. Big other concern with animal products today is the factory farming. And a lot of these animals are given antibiotics and hormones and other things, and there are concerns that these too are affecting cancer risk. Exercise. Okay, yeah, so Kim is saying here, from her research, albumin, which is rich in eggs, she learned that it thickens the blood, and we're learning tonight that that's a good thing or a bad thing. That's bad, and she was saying that would go right along with this, increasing health risk. Okay, exercise. By the way, I'm not trying to tell anyone you have to be a total vegetarian. You all catch that tonight? Just like we read in the Bible this morning, what is God interested in doing? He's interested in blessing us and teaching us the way to profit. God is not a God of restriction. God is a God of freedom. All the things that he asks us to give up are things that are not in our interest to have. You see? It's just like if I saw you going to my vehicle tonight with a big handful of copper. And I'd say, don't take that. And you think I'm, you know, going to yell at you and I'm going to take this precious metal away from you. Start running. Now, I don't know how fit you are, but I don't think there's too many of you who could outrun me carrying a big load of copper. But even if you could, why would I be telling you not to take the copper? So I have something much better for you. And you see, we're holding on to stuff that is of relatively little value, and God is saying, throw that stuff away. I want to give you something much better. You say, no, I'm not, you know, I don't want to go to any more of those health lectures. You see? Because they're going to tell you about everything you're doing wrong. That's what I don't like about it. And I don't know why I went here anyway. Someone dragged me here to these meetings. Here's one of these doctors again, you know, telling people to give up all the stuff that makes life enjoyable. Right? I mean, it's common. This is common. This is what's going on in our world. But what I'm trying to help you see is that's the way people look at God. And they look at God's commandments that way. They say, well, we don't, in our church, we don't talk about any commandments, you see? We're under grace. We're free. It's just wonderful in this church. And they're dying. They got terrible problems in their families. Why? Because they're not listening to what this loving God wants to teach them. So, when I talk with my patients, I try to be a loving doctor and tell them about all the good things that they can do. All the wonderful things, how they can cooperate with natural law by exercising. Do you know how wonderful exercise is? I think we talked about this the other night. I started on an exercise program when I was living. Did any of you remember? Did I tell you this? Minnesota. And you think you get bad winters at Mount Shasta. Does it ever get below 50, minus 50 here? You don't remember that? Minnesota. Okay. That's where you were born. In Moorhead, Minnesota. Okay. Yeah, it gets cold there in the northern plains. My wife is from South Dakota, so she, you know, experienced the same stuff. But if you want to get on an exercise program, that's not like the prime place to pick. And I remember starting on an exercise program, I think it was actually in the late fall. And I was exercising outdoors. Really? But you know, I told you, I got such benefit from exercise. I felt so much better that I stuck with it. It took me several years to realize how much better I was feeling. But it sunk in after a while. Exercise is powerful stuff in improving your blood fluidity. If you want your blood to be optimally fluid, what do you want to do? Exercise, that's right. Move around more. And the more you exercise, the better your hemorheology tends to be. So that's why when you come to one of my lectures, you can get up, you can walk around, you can walk to the back, you can go get a drink. You see how it works? And you're just really on the program. No one can criticize you for getting up. Hey, he was talking about exercise and water. I went to get a drink. Don't give me a hard time that I slipped out for a few minutes. There's an additional way that exercise helps us as far as blood fluidity. It actually helps us to decrease our body fat. As we lose body fat, our fitness improves. Now, some people get upset, though. They say, look, I'm sick of exercise because every time I try to exercise to lose weight, it doesn't work. This is a very fascinating discussion that's been in the medical literature now for a number of years. It's talking about fitness and fatness. Some of the classic research on this looked at a very important question. And let me just ask you as an audience tonight, if you had to choose between being fit and overweight or thin and unfit, what do you think the average American would choose? Thin and unfit, that's exactly right. But these researchers at the Cooper Clinic in Dallas, they found that as far as your longevity, you would be better off choosing to be overweight and fit than unfit and thin. What's really interesting is after they published that research, they started to look at why. Now, this here is looking at different blood factors that are related to fitness and fatness. And I'm going to just show you a few of them. Here's the first one. This is fibrinogen. Have you heard about fibrinogen tonight already? Some of you heard about it because you were awake. Others of you were nodding off. But fibrinogen is what? Who remembers what it is? Yes, it's a clotting protein. High fibrinogen levels, do they help your hemorheology or do they worsen it? That's right. The higher the fibrinogen, the worse you are. Now, it's kind of a technical slide. I'm going to try to make it simple. Those of you that really completely understand what this is showing, you'll understand I'm taking some poetic license. But just to make it simple, we're looking here at two measures. Fitness is on this axis, and weight is on this axis. If you look here, high fitness and normal weight, they have the best fibrinogen levels. If you gain weight, your fibrinogen does not change much as long as you're in the high fitness level. Do you see how that works? But look at this. Even if you're overweight or obese, if you're highly fit, you are better off than anyone, no matter what their weight is, if they're only moderately fit. Do you see this? Dramatically higher fibrinogen levels in moderately fit individuals as compared to the highly fit. So, don't look around you and be proud that you're thinner than someone else, because you can't look around and see how fit someone else is. You with me? So some of you may feel that you're carrying extra weight. Some of us are predisposed genetically to carry extra weight. Some of us, because of our early life history, carry much more weight. But that doesn't mean you can't be fit. How do you get fit? By exercise. So even if you don't lose all the weight that you think you should lose, don't throw in the towel and exercise. Keep exercising, realizing that the fitness is improving your hemorheology and decreasing your risk of a host of problems. Now, some of you might be feeling a little smug right now. It's possible tonight. Well, I know it's not possible. I'm a pretty good judge. You learned this last night. But I know no one here weighs 800 pounds, but let's just say there is someone here tonight who weighs 800 pounds. I know there's not. No one's even close. You're all much thinner than that. And by the way, we've had people in the 600 and 700 pound range come to our program at Weimar. We just had someone leave. I don't share any details about our patients who come through there unless they share them publicly. And this fellow did. He came to our 18-day program at Weimar. He weighed in at 668 pounds. When he left Weimar, what do you think he weighed? 668. So you think our program is that bad? They can't even lose any weight because he gained so much muscle. Well, it's very likely he gained quite a bit of muscle, but he actually left Weimar over 100 pounds lighter. Now, I have to tell you, we've got some perplexed looks. In 18 days, he actually decided he was making so much progress after 18 days that he would stay for a second program. And he decided after two programs he was making so much progress, he would stay for a third. And after a third program, he decided he would stay for a fourth. So he actually stayed for four 18-day programs. So that comes out to about a total, when you include the weekends in between, about 12 weeks. So that would be 3 months. But amazing, isn't it? He lost 100 pounds. It wasn't just fluid weight. You lose some fluid when you lose weight rapidly. But I'm just trying to illustrate. What was he doing? He was doing this New Start program. So it definitely can help you lose weight. Now, not everyone. You know, the heavier you are, the quicker the weight comes off, just so you know. Okay? If you have only 18 pounds to lose, you're not going to lose 18 pounds in 18 days. You with me? But let me tell you, though, if you're one of those heavy people and you're saying tonight, well, I'm very fit, I don't need to be worried about losing weight, that is not the conclusion to make either. You still want to look at your diet and other things that can help you trim down, because there are other things that affect hemorheology that are different than fibrinogen. Here's one of them. This is white blood cell count. Actually, the higher your white blood cell count, the worse your blood fluidity. So a high white blood cell count is not good. And what we find all the time is when people get on a healthier lifestyle, their white count goes down. Now, a lot of people get worried. They say, well, aren't white blood cells supposed to prevent infection? Well, your white blood count doesn't go down so far that you can't fight infection. But think about it. You need less white blood cells if you're on a healthy program. Your immune system's better. You don't need a high white count. And so look here. In this relationship, if you're highly fit, weight makes a huge difference. Look at how much higher the white count is in those with high fitness but who are obese. You'd be better off in terms of the white count to be moderately fit and normal weight than to be obese and highly fit. Do you see that, how that works? So I'm just trying to help you see both fitness and weight are both important when it comes to blood fluidity. Well, tonight, we told you we'd give you lots of time for questions and answers. And I could go into great detail about water and sunshine and temperance. By the way, what is temperance anyway? Do you know? Yeah, it has to do with self-control. You know, today in America, we talk a lot about moderation. And one of the catchphrases is, everything in moderation. Everything in moderation. How many of you think it's a good idea to have cyanide in moderation? No, there are certain things that it's just prudent to avoid altogether. So the concept of temperance is not just moderation. It's moderation in things that are good, but total avoidance of things that are harmful. Do you see how that works? That's the concept of temperance. A stands for air. What kind of air do you think we should be breathing? Fresh air. Mount Shasta air. Now, do you know what the most common pollutant in most environments is? Even today, what is the most common pollutant? Well, particulate matter, but what would be the source of it? If you look at cumulative exposure in America to air pollutants, what would be the main source? Cars, cumulative exposure. It's actually tobacco smoking. Still is. 25% of our population still smokes. And when you smoke, you expose yourself to huge amounts of over 4,000 chemicals. 4,000 chemicals. I talked with one of the leading researchers some years ago in tobacco chemistry, Dietrich Hoffman. I think he's passed away. But I actually worked a little bit with Dr. Hoffman's group in Manhattan some years ago. And I asked him this question because at that time, this was in the, this would have been the early 90s, there was a lot of interest, there still is today, in natural tobacco. And I told you, I work a lot with Native Americans. Many of them think, well, you know, natural tobacco is all good, and it's all these additives that are in tobacco. I said, Dietrich, what do you think about this? They're all worried about these additives. And he said, yeah, there's some truth to that. But he said, don't get all worried about that, because the very worst cancer-producing compounds in tobacco are nitrosamines. These nitrosamines are made when nicotine is burned. And you know what? There is no tobacco product that has ever been sold that has been nicotine-free. They tried it once, but when they made nicotine-free cigarettes, you know what happened? Yeah, people became non-smokers if they stuck with them because the nicotine that kept them hooked. So, what is the best strategy for stopping smoking? I kind of hinted at it last night. I hinted at it. I told you last night that individuals find a certain strategy most successful when it comes to lifestyle change. It's to have a spiritual conviction that you need to change your lifestyle. So here's what I would say. If you're a smoker and you feel you should stop smoking, pray about it. Ask the Creator, ask God, if He really wants you to stop smoking right now. And if He tells you yes, then just go for it. Just believe that if He's asking you to make a change in your lifestyle, that He will give you the power to do it. And how do you do this? Whether it's stopping smoking or getting rid of sugar or leaving off the chocolate, whatever problem you're dealing with, what should you do? Should you say, look it, well, this could be very difficult, so I'm going to keep 10 chocolate bars in my refrigerator in case I'm strongly tempted. Is that a good strategy to be successful? No. How many of you have ever seen here around Mount Shasta a rattlesnake? Any of you ever seen a rattlesnake? Okay. Now, I don't know what the culture is up here in Mount Shasta. When you saw the rattlesnake, let's say you saw it in your house. Have any of you ever seen a rattlesnake in your house? So, you have, huh? Is that true? In Texas, okay, you saw a rattlesnake in your house. What did you do with that rattlesnake? Okay, turn the oven on. That's what one first. Yeah, it's scary. How many, you know, most people, if I ask them, what would happen if you saw a rattlesnake in your house? They would say, well, I'd call somebody who knows how to handle these things. You know, I'd be out of there. That's what most people tell me in most parts of the country. But when I was in Oklahoma, they never said that. You say, oh, we just grab it, you know, and we catch it behind the neck. Okay, well, if that's what you're going to do. But here, in this illustration, that's not the right strategy. How many people die from rattlesnakes every year in America? You have any idea? Yeah, not many. That's the correct answer. Not many. Very few. How many people die from cigarette smoking? Yes, the Centers for Disease Control estimate that some 400,000 or more people die every year in our country who would not have died had they not been smokers. How many people die from overeating and inactivity combined? This is not some radical group. This is Centers for Disease Control. Is the number much smaller than those who die from smoking or larger? It's actually larger. If you combine overeating, bad eating habits, and inactivity, it's actually larger, like 500,000 people a year. Amazing, isn't it? So here we're all afraid. We're all afraid to grab a rattlesnake, but we're not afraid to grab a pack of cigarettes. Or if we have a problem with compulsive overeating of chocolate, we're not afraid to touch chocolate. Do you see where I'm going with this? If you're convicted to make a change in your lifestyle, clean out your house of whatever the problem substances are. If God's convicting you to make a change, get rid of the things and trust Him that He's going to give you the victory. Say, God, You asked me to give these things up. I can't do it on my own. I've tried before, I failed. And then once you've quit, treat it like a rattlesnake. If you find a pack of cigarettes and you're a smoker, you haven't smoked in 2 months, what should you do when the pack of cigarettes fall out of that jacket that you hadn't worn for 6 months? What should you do? That's right. Don't touch it. You know, get a hold. Call somebody else to get rid of it, just like you do with a rattlesnake. Do you see the point? You wouldn't just barehand the cigarettes. They're more dangerous than a rattlesnake. Okay. If you got questions, we'll take them in a minute. But I'm just going through the rest of the list quickly. Air, then rest. Rest is an amazing... I got to show you this. I got to show you one of these slides. This is one of my favorite slides in the whole talk, so I've got to show it to you. There's so many good things we could talk about here. And I do whole series on these topics, but this is one of my favorite slides, so I'm going to show it to you. I'll show you several on rest. Look at this. This is looking at some of the most potent inflammatory compounds that we have today. In fact, if you have a serious autoimmune disease like rheumatoid arthritis or some inflammatory bowel disease, it's likely the doctor will prescribe a drug that suppresses tumor necrosis factor, powerful inflammatory compound. Here's another one called interleukin-6. You don't have to remember the names, but I want to show you something. This was a study of volunteers, 30 healthy volunteers. In the gray are the levels of these inflammatory compounds when they were getting plenty of sleep, 8 hours per night. Then they looked at the same individuals, and they looked at what happened to these inflammatory compounds when they just cut their sleep in half. A lot of people think they do fine on 4 hours of sleep. Look what happens to these inflammatory compounds. They just soar. Either one of these. Many individuals with arthritis have told me if they don't get enough sleep, what happens to their joints the next day? They're much worse. Why is it? One of the reasons is right here. These inflammatory compounds just rise dramatically. Let me show you some other just interesting things while we're talking about rest. This is looking at rest and how it relates to your risk of catching a cold. They interviewed people about their sleep habits. They carefully recorded them over a period of time, and then they actually exposed them to the rhinovirus, one of the causes of a common cold. And look at this. Those who were getting more than 8 hours of sleep had a very low risk of developing a cold. If you were 7 to 8 hours, a higher risk, and less than 7 hours, triple the risk of getting a cold when you're exposed to the rhinovirus as opposed to someone getting plenty of sleep. Isn't that interesting? Let me see if I put one other. Oh, this is another fascinating research study. I love the title of this. This is another aspect of rest. We've been talking about getting enough sleep at night, but look at this. This is a study in the medical research literature. This is the title, Death Rests a While. holy day and Sabbath effects on Jewish mortality in Israel. In this fascinating study, the researchers found that those who took the Sabbath rest had dramatically decreased mortality. You see, they actually followed death rates in Israel over a number of years. And they looked at the Jewish population, and they found that when they came to Friday night, which is when the Sabbath begins in the Bible culture, and into Saturday, the death rates dropped dramatically. And they say, well, that's because in Israel, obviously, their day of rest is Saturday instead of Sunday, which is true. But you know what? There's a lot of non-Jews that live in Israel, and they looked at what happened to their death rates. They didn't change at all. There was a special effect in those people that were regarding this special day of rest. You know, many cultures have valued a day of rest, but we've lost that in the Western world. Isn't it interesting that one of the commandments in the Bible commanded us to do what? To remember the Sabbath day. Isn't that interesting? To remember that special day of rest. Well, I want to finish my presentation with that.